ॐ पार्वताय प्रतिपूजितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम्.
A few more things to say about this verse 29, and then we'll go on from there.
Ascharyavat pasyati kaschidenam. Ascharyavat varati tathaiva chanyaha. Ascharyavat varati tathaiva chanyaha. Ascharyavat chayanam anyashrinoti. Ascharyavat chayanam anyashrinoti. Shrutvapyenam vedana chayva kaschit. Shrutvapyenam vedana chayva kaschit. Ascharyavat pasyati kaschit enam. Ascharyavat vadati tata eva cha anyaha. Ascharyavat cha enam anyaha shrinoti shrutva api enam veda nacha eva kaschit.
Last week we went through this verse having ascharyavat being an adjective or description of the Atma. Right? The other way that this verse is read, and I just touched on it at the end of the verse, is with the ascharyavat being a description of the seeker, or the hearer, the teacher. So reading it like that, which is how Shankara actually takes it, and it can be taken any way, in either way, because that vat affix, ascharya means a wonder. Ascharyavat means like a wonder. So if it says ascharyavat pasyati kaschit, a person, kaschit just means a person, sees enam, a person sees this. Some person who sees this is like a wonder. Right? There's some person, any person. Kaschit means a person instead of the person. It means a person. Some person out there. Kaschit. Okay? Some person out there. Some person who sees this, they're like a wonder. You know? Or a person who sees the self, right? The person who sees the self like a wonder, right? Where the Atma sees the self as a wonder. Or the person who sees the self, they are like a wonder. Okay. So either way is fine. Both are true.
It's well rounded.
So here, ascharyavat. Let's look at ascharyavat pasyati kaschit enam. The one who sees this, the person who actually sees this, that person is like a wonder. So now, what do they mean? As a jiva in this creation, everything about you, your body, your mind, your sense organs, your organs of action, are meant solely to interplay, to interface with the creation. If you think of your five sense organs, what are they for? To see the five sense objects. That's what they're for. What is the mind for? Well, the mind relates to the five sense organs, gaining thought modifications and knowledge, whether it be perception or inference or presumption or whatever the means of knowledge. Those means of knowledge gain their data from sense perception. Okay? Your mind also, all of its content, whether you're daydreaming or dreaming or thinking, is based upon data that is gathered from the world. data which is gathered and understood within the context of duality. Even if you're using big words like consciousness, it's consciousness of something. It's not infinite, changeless, limitless consciousness. It's consciousness of something. If you're talking about eternal, it's something that goes on, that lasts forever. We don't mean timeless, right? Changeless. We can't mean timeless or changeless because there is no such thing in the creation. Everything in the creation is bound by time, right? Then when we say a word like infinite, what do we mean? Spatially infinite, qualitatively infinite, numerically infinite, right? We don't mean one without a second. That concept isn't even there. Infinite in the sense that there is only one thing and nothing else. That's actually the true meaning of infinite, if we really break it down. If you say something is infinite, that means there's not room for anything else. But when we use it within duality, like numerically infinite, for instance. So all of these, everything that you have available to you as an upadhi, right, for gaining knowledge and for interacting in the world, is good, excellent, wonderful, for gaining knowledge within the box of duality, for within the box of the creation. But now, that's not what you're seeing. The person who sees the Atma is not seeing. What they're seeing is other than, right? It's other than just solely the nama rupa or the names and forms in their infinite variety that make up the creation. What they are seeing, is this, that the Atma, they are seeing the self-evident Atma plus the creation. So now, there's a trick in those words. The self-evident conscious being that you are, your sense organs are not seeing. Your mind is not seeing. Right? It's that self-evident consciousness that sees itself, not in a subject-object relationship, but which is consciousness itself and self-evident. Right? So because it's consciousness, it sees itself, but not as a subject-object relationship. So we don't really say it like that. We say it's self-luminous, self-evident, self-luminous. So that self-evident, self-luminous being that I am is not something that my eyes can turn around and see. It's the conscious being which is the self of the eyes. The mind can't turn around and see it. It's the conscious being which is the self of the mind. And so this type of seeing is totally different. It's the seeing of the mind that is a seeing that's brought up, that is actually a recognition and a differentiation. A recognition on the part of the mind that it itself is objectified. And that the conscious being, which is present as the very being of the mind, like the clay of the pot, that conscious being is self-evident, not being witnessed by the mind, but is its own witness. Its own consciousness is its own witness because of being self-evident. But because it's self-evident, the mind can differentiate its experience, recognizing within the mind what are the things which are seen, what are the things that are coming and going, and what is the self-evident being that is not seen but is self-luminous. And so that is an extraordinary type of seeing. It's a seeing that doesn't involve any of the instruments of knowledge that you usually use for seeing. And the Vedanta, the teaching methodology, is an extraordinary type of teaching, right? Because it's making the student, step by step by step, see what can't be seen. So it's not a matter of seeing now. A seeing becomes a recognition. So here it says, Ascharyavat Pashyati Kaschit Enam. That person who sees this, that person is a wonder. Because people can't walk around seeing this, right? You don't have that means of knowledge available to you as a human being to see this. You are this, but your sense organs and mind can't make you see it. It's a different kind of recognition. So the one who does see it, that person is truly a wonder. And then it says, Ascharyavat Vadati Tathayavacha Anyaha. And the other person, the one who speaks of it, Vadati, who talks of it, who teaches it, similarly, in the same way, that person is a wonder. Because that person has to talk about and unfold and reveal that which is not an object to be talked about. Right? And some of this Neo-Vedanta, they'll, or different traditions, they dismiss the mind and the teacher, in fact. Right? Because, obviously, the self is not an object to be talked about. There's no words that can describe it. Right? There's no eyes that can see it. Yeah? There's no mind that can know it. And the Kena Upanishad, for instance, will say all these things. You have to understand what they're saying. The eyes can't see it as an object. The mind can't know it as an object. It's not a matter of subject-object relationship. That's why I say all of the words that we use. Say you're reading an Upanishad, and you're though the Atma. The Atma is Satchitananda. The Atma is existence. It is consciousness. You know, it is Ananda, which really means Ananta. It's limitless. What do these words mean? Right? So the meaning of these words have to be handled by that teaching tradition to make the words point to what they are implying, not the worldly definition of the words that is caught within duality. So the words have to point to the reality of yourself, which is consciousness, but it's not consciousness of something. It is existence, but not existence as an adjective like the existent lamp or the existent chair, right? It's existence itself, non-objectifiable existence, which is consciousness. How can the words make you see that when it's not the conscious being that is being unfolded by the words is not an object for you to recognize? It would be impossible. Impossible. Except that you are that. Because you are that, the words can point you to that recognition. This was Jung's whole problem, in fact. He said, oh, there's some, they talk, the Upanishads, they talk about a limitless consciousness, but what can we do with that? We can never know it. There's a limitless consciousness out there somewhere. How can I know that? And so then, how can it help me? Because I can only know things, you know, which I can objectify and come into a subject-object relationship. So if you're talking about a limitless, you know, consciousness, I have no means of knowledge to experience that. And so that means, which is reasonable. He's a very intelligent man, but he didn't have any access to a pramana or a teaching methodology, nor the recognition that I am that limitless consciousness. And that limit, what do they mean by limitless? One without a second. Limitless doesn't mean large. When we use the word limitless, it's not spatially limitless. It's not numerically limitless. It's not qualitatively limitless. It's limitless in the sense that it is one without a second. There's nothing else. That's the limitless. And so that limitless doesn't have to do with size. And so the teaching has to take your mind, help your mind to differentiate all of the maya, the mitya, all of the things that come and go, that change, that are all of the variables. You know, the things that have a beginning and end, to make you recognize the clay of the pot, to recognize the changeless being, self-lit, self-evident being that you are, that you can't do anything about. The mind can't touch it. When they say the mind can't touch it, that doesn't mean the mind's away from it. The mind can't touch it. The mind can't change it. The mind can't modify it. What this means is so profound, because we're saying whatever is going on in your mind, whatever moods are in the mind, whatever feelings, whatever anxiety or depression or joy or happiness or anxiety, these are all states of mind that are really generated by the way we relate to the world, actually. You know? But nevertheless, these states of mind, some positive, some negative, in no way affect my being. They don't affect my being even Well, see, we'll say this is what people will think this means.
Well, we know it really doesn't affect my being, but the problem is, even though that's true, of course, it doesn't affect my being. When my mind is like that, then my being is covered just like the clouds cover the sun. Or just, right, the sun's not covered, is it? But if the clouds, a rainstorm comes in, then even though the clouds, the sun is not covered, I don't get to experience it. This is always the problem. And then we think, so then what we're thinking, you know, so I understand clearly, that I never change, just like the sun. I know that. But, this is that with it's, where Swamiji's joking all the time, but, you know. So this is the problem. There's still the identity I still have the identity there with the mind, or being on the other side of the clouds. Rather than recognizing my being, which is self-evident, I'm the one that's illumining the clouds. If my mind is cloudy, or my mind is agitated, I am the conscious being. I am the self-evident conscious being that is illumining that mental state, whatever it is. The mental state might be unpleasant. We don't want an agitated state of mind. We don't want a depressed state of mind. That's a different thing, that's true. That's not the point. The point is that myself, like the sun, which is the very being of the mind, is not covered in any way. It's just that I am there illumining a very rainy day. And that rainy day, that depressed, sad mind, has its own affect, which is being experienced. But that experience doesn't cover me. I am also there, illumining the experience. And this is what needs to be recognized. I am there illumining whatever it is as the very center of it, as the very conscious being, whatever that experience is. That is jnanam. Right? That's why when we did this meditation just today, and you just learn how to relax your mind by bringing in an attitude that allows it to relax. You know, a non-confrontive, a non-hostile attitude, just an attitude of gratitude, an attitude of love, an attitude of appreciation. That lets the body and mind relax. When you let the body and mind just relax and be, it changes qualitatively. And that relaxed state becomes more quiet, more subtle. And in that condition, your being, the clay of the pot, your own presence, becomes predominant, because the mind isn't competing with a lot of thought flow or with a lot of hurt feelings or negativity or whatever. It has become quiescent, at least for the time being. And so is your body. And so then you can recognize, oh, this is me. The mind's talk. The mind says, oh, yeah, this is me. I can't change myself. Try to put a bag over your head. Try to make yourself non-existent. Try to make yourself be different in any way. Let the mind play and try to change that self-evident presence. Let the mind get to know that, to recognize, I am here, and no matter what the thoughts are, what the feelings are, nothing can be done. Nothing can change me at all. Let the mind test it. Try it. Get to know that fact. And then, during the day, as the mind goes about its business, being engaged with all the things we have to do in the day, which are many, let it continue to check back in and recognize, oh, I'm still here. Oh, nothing has happened. It's still me. It's still me. Until it doesn't have to check back in. It doesn't have to do that. Because that recognition, the recognition of that changeless presence, that changeless, benign presence of myself, that indestructible self, is my reality. The mind has recognized, through all of its trial and error, through all of its testing, nothing can be done to shake me or harm me in any way.
And so the teacher, and the teacher has to make the student see that. The teacher makes the student see that through a teaching methodology that's been passed down from teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student. It's very, very thorough. That's what the Upanishads are. The Bhagavad Gita is. All of these Prakarana Granthas, like the Panchadashi and Atma Bodha, Tattva Bodha, all of these, and many Drikdrisha Viveka, all of these texts, they're teaching methodologies to make the students see this over and over and over from every conceivable angle until the mind says, finally it just says, yeah, that's right. No more, it doesn't have any more questions. It's seen it from every conceivable angle. And then what happens is the mind goes on seeing and seeing and seeing and seeing and seeing and appreciating and appreciating. But it's seeing what it's already known. It's seeing what it already knows. All the beautiful nuances of it. You know, that lie because the creation is so infinite. You know, and all of the relationships or the nuances of that truth, the nuances of Bhagavan, of Ishwara, keep on, the connections keep on growing and growing and growing. But yourself isn't growing and growing and growing. Yourself isn't becoming more clear or less clear. Yourself is yourself. It's known. And then you have nishta in that. Nothing can shake it. So here, the Ascharyavat Vadati, so the one who speaks of it is a wonder. Ascharyavat enam anyaha shranoti. The one who speaks it, the one who sees it is a wonder. Actually, it's seeing all of us as the Atma, the self. One who speaks of it, the acharya, the teacher, that person is a wonder. The one who hears it, the student, is a wonder. How can you hear this? What are you hearing? Everything you're hearing is maya, right? You're not hearing anything. I mean, what you're hearing, the words, are all part of the dream. They're all part of the creation. But the words are landing on yourself. The words direct the mind to a recognition. And so here you're hearing these words, but what you're recognizing is not the words. What you're recognizing is what the words have made the mind, what the words have revealed to the mind. Right? And it's not that the mind knows the self as an object. The mind has recognized that its self is Atma, that its self is changeless, that it is changing, that it is Maya, but itself is changeless. So that's why the mind, then you can legitimately say, I am changeless. Those are words. It's a mind saying. You're, as a jiva, I'm sitting here, I'm saying, I am changeless. Right? And if I say that, I am changeless, I'm not saying the body is changeless, because the body changes. It's born and dies. I'm saying, I am changeless. I, the one who is the self of the body, the Dehi, I am changeless. I say that sitting here with my mind changing. I say, I am changeless. What are the words referring to? Not the changing mind. They are referring to me, the self of the changing mind, the me, this me right here, which is changeless. If I sit before you right now, I say, I am changeless. I'm seeing you. I'm relating to you. I'm a person sitting here. I'm not having some experience. I'm not having a supernatural experience of a changeless self that is other than me. See what I mean? There's no experience out there. Then what people will think, oh, the teacher, you know, she says or he says, I am changeless. And you know, even though she's sitting here talking to me, she doesn't really see me. She doesn't really see me, and she's not really talking, and she doesn't really hear me either. But we see her seeing and talking, but that's not really what's going on. No. Well, there's some truth in that, isn't there? On one level. But then you're not seeing either. If that's it, you're not seeing, and you're not hearing, right? And you're not thinking, and you don't have a body either. And in fact, none of us are here. So if you're going to say that about the teacher, you have to say that about the student, right? And you can say, because in truth, there is only one self. But now you see how there's this shifting of levels?
There's a jumping from levels. So that we think now in this level, here we all are, but we're really not seeing anything. Well, yes, we are. You know, as long as I have eyes here and ears, my eyes are seeing, my ears are thinking, my mind is, my ears are hearing, my mind is thinking. I am feeling. I have a physical body that I can go like this. All of these things are happening. All within this particular order of reality. But then, am I thinking? No. Am I seeing? No. Is my being, now I'm jumping a level. To who are this me? The self that I am. From my own standpoint, right now, am I thinking? No. But I am the self of the mind which is thinking. Right? If I am thinking, truly, then I can't be you. Because I'm thinking, and you're thinking, but you're thinking something differently than I'm thinking. So consciousness is not thinking. The upadhi is thinking. See what I mean? But the truth of the upadhi is me, is consciousness. Now, another interesting thing. When you sit in silence, you're sitting in meditation, right? And you're just relaxed. And you just let your mind be as it is. You know, and actually, this is an absolutely normal state. You're not doing anything. You're just simply sitting. You're relaxed. Your mind is thinking or doing whatever it's doing. This is just a human condition. Okay? But now you're slowing things down, which is what we want you to do, so you can kind of take note of the condition. And now one thing you notice is that here you are. All is well. All is relaxed. And your mind is thinking thought after thought after thought. You are there, present to those thoughts. Are you thinking? You are present to the thoughts. Mm-hmm. Right? You are present to the sounds. Are you the sounds or are you present to the sounds? See what I mean? You're hearing the sounds. The sounds are being heard. Mm-hmm. Right? You are present to those sounds. You are conscious of those sounds. Are you the sound? No. Now, another thing. If you say, I am conscious of the sound. See if we use this. This is a tricky language. All right. I'm sitting here quietly. There's a sound. I am conscious of the sound. Have I done something to become conscious of the sound? Well, first of all, I need my ears. Without the ears, I won't be conscious of the sound. Second of all, I need my mind to be using the ears. Because I could be daydreaming. The sound could take place. My ears work. But I wouldn't be conscious of the sound because my mind is elsewhere. Right? So what it comes down to basically then is even in terms of, okay, sound has come, the mind is utilizing the ears, so now I have a thought modification of sound in my mind. That sound is illumined by consciousness. Put another way. That sound takes place in silence. If it doesn't, then won't the noise compete with the sound? No. The sound takes place in silence. Is awareness, does awareness have a sound? Does awareness make a sound? Does awareness hear a sound? It's very interesting. Does awareness hear a sound? Awareness is not the ears. Awareness is not the mind. Now, think of it like this. Here comes the sound into the mind. The mind has the thought modification of the sound. So now that sound is known. Okay? Is awareness doing something to know the sound? Say no. The sound goes away, now there's another thought modification, that is known. Now there's another thought modification, that is known. Another, that is known. Is awareness busily knowing all of these thought modifications? Say no. The thought modifications, it's the nature of the mind, sukshma, subtle, nature of the mind, is that whatever thought modification is there, it is known. What does the known belong to? Every thought modification is known.
What gives it the state of being known? We say that is the awareness. The state of being known belongs to the awareness, to the consciousness. Is it performing a function? No. But a thought modification, when we say reflects awareness, all we really mean there is that the awareness is pervasive to that thought modification. And so whatever the thought modification is taking place, that thought modification is known. Okay? So now, in meditation, say you're making your mind quiet and you're just watching your thought after thought after thought. You ask, let the mind ask yourself, am I a knower? This conscious being that is present. Am I a knower? Am I performing an action of knowing? And you'll see, no, I just am. I just am. I am. And the amness that I am is self-evident. It is self. I am self-evident. And I'm not doing anything. And once you notice that in meditation, you say right now, are you doing anything? Your own presence. No, you just simply are. Your mind is thinking, your sense organs are active, your body is active, you're engaged in the world. But the me, your own presence, is anything doing? Are you doing anything? No. You just simply are. And what is that being like? The being that you are, what is that? Do you want it to be different? And then when you start asking that, do you want it to be different? And the answer is no. You can't even imagine it to be different. It's inconceivable to think of this being that you are to be different. That is what we mean by ananda. It's inconceivable to even think or want or imagine, you can't even imagine this being to be different. That's the beloved. That's the ananda. That's what needs to be recognized from so many different ways. So then, so the teacher who's teaching this, the student who's hearing it, right? Because you're not really hearing it, but the words are making you recognize that reality that's not an object to be heard. Okay. Those are, both of them are wonder. And then, shrutva api enam veda. But then, what's also a great wonder is a person, even though they've heard this, they don't get it. They still don't know the self. And that is also a great wonder. And this is why. It is a great wonder. It's a great wonder because it's you. We're not talking about somebody else. We're talking about you and what is immediately present. You know? It's immediately present, and there's nothing more simple. And once you understand, say, there is nothing more simple. It is cut and dried. And you can't believe that you could not know this, because once you know, it's the knowing of the obvious. That's why in Shankar's very famous Adhyasa Bhasha, which begins the Brahma Sutras, his introduction to the Brahma Sutras is just two or three pages dealing with this problem of superimposition, right? So, dealing with this problem of superimposition that's born from ignorance. So he starts out in the first couple of sentences saying, you know, there are certain things which are impossible. Oh, wow. These get just more and more outrageous. That's the, you know, Maya. Okay. So anyway, certain things are impossible, like light and darkness. You can't bring the two together. Right? You can't bring the two together. It's impossible. You can't bring knowledge and, like, knowledge and ignorance, subject and object. These aren't possibilities. But this is what has happened to us. We take ourselves to be an object that we're aware of and get caught in this superimposition. We take ourselves to be something that we are experiencing, looking at, objectifying. How is this possible? He said, it's not possible, but here we are. And then he starts talking about this beginningless ignorance. This beginningless ignorance that is natural to all beings. And though when you analyze it, it's ridiculous and impossible, here we are. But then he analyzes also the very nature of ignorance itself is how ignorance is beginningless. And ignorance is there. It is beginningless, but it comes to an end. Why do we say it's there as though it's something to be removed? Well, very simply because the ignorance that we fall prey to or affects us has effects. Like, for instance, any ignorance, an ignorance like the rope snake. You know, the ignorance has to cover the rope, but if it covers the rope, it has a second quality of projecting something upon it, right? So you can have total ignorance. They say like going to deep sleep. That's total ignorance. If you go into deep sleep, nothing is known. So we have ignorance is bliss when we say that total ignorance is bliss, not partial ignorance. Total ignorance, like in deep sleep. But our situation where ignorance has this twofold power that we call avarana and vikshepa, avarana means it covers, there's partial ignorance, not total ignorance. That's our problem. Like, for instance, with a rope snake, you have partial ignorance, not total ignorance, because you have the experience of the rope. But you miss that it's a rope. That's partial ignorance. The experience is there without a recognition of what the experience is. Then there's the covering of the experience, right? So you have the bends of the rope, but not the recognition that it's a rope. So, and those are the conditions. Those are the perfect conditions. There's a covering and a projection.
That's
vikshepa. Vikshepa. For yourself, for your situation as a jiva, it's the same. I am here, the me. You experience yourself as yourself. But you take this self-experience, which is absolutely correct when you say, I am. I am so-and-so. You know? Even when you say, I am the body, that I am is labeling, the first part of it, is labeling you perfectly. That is the experience that is there, that is then not fully recognized. Because I don't recognize that I am Brahman. And so since I don't recognize myself that I am Brahman, that I am changeless, that I am limitless, the mind doesn't. It's the mind that's got the problem here. Then what does it do? Well, then what am I? I'm me, the mind says. That's the adhyasa. The mind, when it says, I am me, what it means, I am the self, it takes the conscious being that I am, the changeless conscious being that I am, and identifies it with itself. And then I, which is correct, the me that you know yourself to be, now takes on all of the qualities of your mind. Your mind is changing. Sometimes it's happy, sometimes it's sad. Your mind also abides within this body. This body dies. Then, therefore, the mind will say, the body dies. Do I die or do I belong to a soul that leaves? I don't know. And then all these type of philosophies come, right? Because the mind doesn't know. But it knows, and it knows, and it doesn't know. What does it know? It's its own self-experience, the self-evident experience of me. I'm a conscious being. But that's self-evident. You don't have to be a jnani for that. Everybody knows that. It's absolutely self-evident. It's the truth of a mosquito. You know, this mosquito sense of self is me. So that doesn't, you don't gain that with knowledge. You recognize with knowledge who you are. You recognize who you are. You don't gain the experience of who you are. You already have that. You gain the recognition of who you are.
in reference to the body and mind, sense organs, world, universe, God, creation, Maya, all of that. So amidst this experience of everything changing, you recognize I'm changeless. Amidst this experience of everything changing, you recognize that your self is not one of the objects. Yourself is the very being of all of the objects. But that requires teaching, right? Requires seeing. It requires a teaching that makes you see. But what it's making you see is yourself. And so since you are here, the thought that teaching can, you can hear that teaching and then not know, that's incredible. In the Katha Upanishad, also in Shankara, in his one Bhasha, in one of the verses in the Katha Upanishad, he also goes on and on about this power of Maya. How strong it is that in spite of being told and shown that you are infinite, you are the whole, you cling to, you means everyone, you cling to being a limited jiva. You know? So he says something like, come on, get over it. what's better? Why do you want to keep staying as a jiva? I've made this so clear. Why are you clinging to this? So he jokes. You know, he has a couple few pages on it. You know? I think sometimes, you know, Swamiji would kind of joke that maybe sometimes he would get a little frustrated. Yeah, he has a good, Shankara has a really nice sense of humor. His unfoldment is so precise and so clear and so kind of methodical with using beautiful, beautiful language. But he has a personality too. You know, like once in a while he'll throw in little zingers and little jokes and things like that. Very, very nice. He's wonderful. Shankara is worth learning Sanskrit for, just to appreciate him. Okay, I think let's stop there.
Gosh. That's wonderful.
Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.